This is Paddock Pass podcast number 398. Dave, Neil, do you feel old? We've got a double special this week as we drift out of World SBK at the TT Circuit Assen. Steve's show with Gordo and the ever welcome Matt Oxley will drop this Friday. And we move into round four of MotoGP at Jerez and the Gran Premio de España. Coming up, we'll see how awake Dave and Neil are with their Jerez trivia, tackle three discussion points about the Grand Prix this weekend, and we've also got an exclusive interview of MotoGP legend and three-time world champion Wayne Rainey that we managed to grab at the Circuit of the Americas last week. Firstly, a reminder to have a browse of rental.com for any essential accessories and component upgrades you need for your street bike. The British firm are not only off-road kings and authentic handlebar innovators, but they also have a rack of parts for the road. It was good to bump into Rentals' David Kaiser at Cotter, and we're more than happy to keep pushing a quality brand. Dave, you're back in the Netherlands after being in the UK. Are you ready for a terrific tapa or a turgid cafe con leche?
I will be staying away from the turgid cafe con leche because then I'd have to kill someone whoever happened to serve it to me. That's a terrible mistake to make. But no, I'm looking forward to Jerez. Jerez is the traditional opening of the European season, although we've been in Europe, but Portugal is such a strange track that it doesn't really seem like Europe. So, yeah, and the atmosphere is always amazing and it's a fantastic location. It's just the weather doesn't look to be fantastic.
Yeah, we're going to get highs of around 20 degrees. I think that's not sort of the usual peak hot weather in Jerez. But Neil, it is Jerez, which means you won't be the most important Morrison at the circuit. Are you looking forward to getting back on comms duty as well?
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a family affair at Jerez. Yeah, always one of the high points of the season. Like Dave said, it's a wonderful time of year, wonderful place in Andalusia. And yeah, pretty good track. And as you said, Ad, the weather is not going to be as hot as it normally is. We're used to highs of 28, 29 degrees, really high track temperatures. But it does seem as though it's going to be a good bit cooler. I think we're going to Jerez maybe a week earlier than normal this year, which is playing a part. So yeah, that might affect the racing somewhat. But yeah, I think there's so much to look forward to this weekend. I was just rewatching the Austin race yesterday, and there's plenty to talk about going into this weekend.
I will have a prediction later on, but we'll save that for the end.
Will it be one? You used the word singular there. I mean, usually it's plural.
No, this will definitely be one prediction. It'll definitely be one prediction, one very concrete prediction, which I am 100% certain will happen.
Well, listen, we're going to kick off this Jerez preview show with a little quiz, and we hope listeners or viewers can join in by answering faster than any of our two so-called experts. In the interest of fairness, and because you're such a freaky font of information, Neil, we're going to give Dave first dibs at the questions and then allow you a shot afterwards. Are you happy with that situation?
Yeah. All right. I'm still confident in my chances.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, and I'm confident of being completely humiliated. So, come on. I mean, you know, look, I am old. I can barely remember my own first name. So, yes, I'm sure I shall absolutely slaughter this.
Well, if you're ready for 10 fiendish ones, compiled with the help of my friend, Mr. Wikipedia, here we go. I suspect that Neil is stiffening slightly. I do detect some apathy in Dave's expression. Where's Cormac GP's competitiveness when you need it? But anyway, listen, number one. Okay, an easy one. What year did Jerez first host a Grand Prix?
Oh, gosh, 87?
Is that right, Neil?
Yes.
On the money, Dave. What a positive start. There we go.
Good. Oh, my God.
Question two, where was the Spanish GP held from 1950 to 1968?
I suspect it's Montjuïc in Barcelona, but I'm not sure.
Can you see these questions somehow?
But I mean, like, I happen to know because of Dennis Noyes' fantastic story about Montjuïc, and also, I have a soft spot for Montjuïc. It's a lovely little sort of hill. I like when I'm in Barcelona, I like wandering around there. So, it's just one of those things.
But an absolutely bonkers place to race a motorcycle.
Completely, yeah. But I mean, like, let's face it, for up until about 1985 or 6, most of the places we raced were bonkers places to be racing motorbikes.
Neil, apologies. That's 2 out of 2. I think you're not going to be, you know, having much input here. All right, question 3. Angel Nieto with 11 and Valentino Rossi on 9 have the most wins at Jerez, but 5 riders are tied on 3rd with 5 wins each. Name one.
Oh, gosh. Marquez?
Over to Neil.
Jorge Lorenzo?
Yes. So the 5 are Hans-Georg Anscheid. Maybe I said that wrong. Jorge Martinez, Jorge Lorenzo, Pier Paolo Bianchi, who took all of his wins in the 125 and 80cc categories, and Eugenio Lazzarini, 4 of which were achieved on 50cc's. So there we go. There's a few random names there. Come on, Dave, get back on the horse. Question 4, who holds the current lap record at Jerez?
Oh, gosh. I have no idea. I'm going to say Pekka Bagnaia. It probably isn't Pekka. No. Jorge Martin.
No, Pekka Bagnaia. From what I've seen, you know, and Neil's kind of nodding as well. Neil's back on the sidelines. Question 5, half of the way there. What was the last Spanish brand to win at Jerez?
Derby.
Neil?
Yeah, I'd probably go along with that. Can I just say this is quite unfair that Dave has got first dibs in all of these questions?
That's only because I'm actually getting some of them right, which is just absolutely shocking.
The answer is actually GasGas in 2022 with Izan Guevara. Yeah. So, but otherwise, Derby was the right answer in 2010. Can anyone guess the rider?
2010.
Oh, gosh. No idea. It'll be 125, yes.
Yeah, it wasn't Moto 3 then.
No.
It was, oh my God.
Come on, Neil, poor radio.
It's Paul Spargo, no?
That's right. You got it. But it's a shame you're not keeping scores. We have to do like sort of a Clive Anderson, you know, whose line is it anyway? Yeah, that was 10 million points. Well done. Question 6, Dave. True or false, Maverick Viñales, winner of the last GP, of course, in the United States, has never won at Jerez.
I think he has never won at Jerez.
It's false. It's false because he has won at Jerez. 2013.
Oh, there he is. There's Model the Neil 3. Morrison we all know. 2013 winner in Moto 3. Question 7. Dave, this one's maybe a little bit trickier for you. Name 3 of the named corners at Jerez.
Am I allowed to use the old corners?
What do you mean, the old corners?
Well, I mean, like, turn 6 is dry sack, but it's also, I think, the Danny Pedrosa corner now. There's Aspar. There is, obviously, the Jorge Lorenzo corner. There's another one as well, which I can't remember. Turn 7, I think, or turn 6. Isn't turn 7 now Carmelo Espeleta corner as well?
Is that has that been ratified, or is that actually due to happen?
Oh, I think it's happening this weekend or something, because he's getting a corner.
So you've moved from past to present to future with these namings. I mean,
exactly.
Okay, Neil, any more corner names? You know, being a commentator, I expect you know all of them.
Yeah, there's Crivier, there's Ferrari, there's Pulucchio, there's, did they say Angel Nieto? Oh, Pulucchio, sorry, yeah, Angel Nieto,
yeah,
as Pulucchi's well.
Turn 1 is bizarrely called Expo 92 for some reason. You have Senna, there's a Senna curve, from what I know, and there's a Michelin corner as well. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any sort of Pirelli banners around that particular corner this weekend. Okay.
Which one is Michelin corner, by the way?
I think it's turn 5.
Okay.
Anyway. Okay. Just to keep... Question 8, Dave. What is the top speed at Jerez?
I don't know exactly. I'm going to say 297. I know it's 29 something or other.
Neil?
So 297.
295.
It's actually 300K notched by Joan Zarco. So that's 186 miles per hour, which is actually quite surprising, isn't it? I mean, Jerez, as we know, and we'll talk about later, is quite a compact circuit. All right.
Yeah, it's the way that you carry. It's the way that you carry speed off of turn five down the straight. It's just, I mean, like, and that is one of my favorite places to go and look. Turn five. It's just stunning.
We're actually recording this show on St. George's Day, and it's only partially related to this question. But Dave, name me three British winners of the Spanish Grand Prix.
God, I don't know. Mike Hailwood? Hang on. Sam Lowes. I think Sam Lowes has won a Grand Prix.
The others are quite old, just to give you a clue.
No, exactly. I'm going to be having to go back and say, look at the 1950s or something. No, I have no idea. Apart from Sam Lowes, I have no idea.
Over to Neil.
Oh, God. How old are we talking at?
Pretty old.
60s.
Two of the deceased, at least.
Goodness. In that case, I'm not sure. Hailwood?
No, Dave said that already. Bill Ivey won some races. Oh, Phil Reed, right. Chas Mortimer, and Fergus Anderson. So there we go.
If it's St. George's Day or San Jordi, then surely we could also be allowed to name Catalan winners.
Oh, that would be a good one.
Well, that's easy, really, isn't it? You know, Jorge Lorenzo.
Well, no, he's not Catalan.
No, he isn't, no.
He's Mallorcan.
Yeah, he speaks Catalan, but he's not born in Catalonia. I think he got
Marc Márquez.
Pedrosa, Márquez.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
And Cuvier. Did Cuvier win the Spanish Grand Prix?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Finally, question 10. Name three title sponsors of the Grand Prix at Jerez, one of which being a tobacco brand.
Red Bull, Red Bull, and Red Bull. Does that count? Because that's three different Grand Prix.
I don't think you could smoke Red Bull, Dave, but over to Neil.
Camel?
No.
Marlboro?
Yes.
Ducados?
Yes.
Michelin?
No. Ducados, Lucky Strike, Marlboro, B-Win, Guru by Griffin, Red Bull. There we go. There were your selections. I think I have either memories or maybe some old race programs tucked away somewhere of Jerez Grand Prix with Marlboro, because it had a very sort of distinctive cover, didn't it? You know, sort of the red and the white chopping across it, sort of like one of those iconic motorcycling programs. But whatever happened to them? All right. Well, I mean, was that? That wasn't quite the abject failure I thought it was going to be. You did pretty well there, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't get 0 out of 10, so I'm quite impressed with myself.
KTM are heading to a racetrack that proved to be very effective for them in 2023. Why not see what the Austrians are all about on the asphalt with a pick of their awesome Duke naked bike range? There are 7 options in the 2024 collection. The KTM 1390 Super Duke R and Evo versions, the 990, the 790, the 390, the 250 and the 125. So the full scale for commuting or any other tire shredding means. Loads of torque, great performance, the latest electronics and unmissable style. There's a KTM Duke for everyone. No bullshit. All right, guys, let's just move on to our three talking points coming into the Grand Prix this weekend. First of all, over to you, Neil, for your opinion first on this one. Will Ducati go 4 in a row this weekend? And who will be potentially the biggest challenges? Is it going to be Aprilia or KTM based on what we've seen this year and, of course, what happened 12 months ago in Spain?
It's a really interesting question. And I think you are maybe going into the GP thinking that Ducati riders aren't actually the favourites, just from what we've seen this year and from what we've seen in the last couple of years at Jerez. I think we had Aleix Espargaró on pole last year and was arguably the fastest guy, but just couldn't really overtake others. We had the two KTMs up there finishing on the podium. Brad Binder won the sprint sensationally at Jerez last year. And there's been a certain 19-year-old rookie that has been catching everyone's attention, whose name escapes me just now, who I think could well be a major, major factor here this weekend. So the Ducati guys were just a little bit off the boil in Cota. I think they'll be a little bit concerned by these rear chatter issues that have been persisting for the likes of Bagnaia, for Jorge Martin, pretty much since the first race of the season. They might be saved somewhat by the fact that we won't have the blisteringly high track temperatures that we normally get in Jerez. But yeah, I think we're going into this weekend maybe looking at the likes of Pedro Acosta, Maverick Vinales, Brad Binder, maybe as the guys that you're looking at dead certs to be up there fighting at the front, because I don't think we could say that the likes of Martin Bagnaia, Bastianini are maybe certified to be there this weekend. So yeah, I think it's going to be really, really interesting. It should be a class weekend.
Yeah, I mean, normally it is, well, yes, if you'd looked at sort of last year, you would have thought, yeah, no, GK, you're absolutely nailed on. But that is, you know, very far from being the case. I mean, last year we also had two fantastic races, both the sprint race and the main race, with the KTMs really taking it to Pekka Bagnaia. There's a whole bunch of things sort of going on. First of all, I think the cold temperatures are actually going to make Ducati's chatter problems worse, because the thing about Jerez is once the track temperature gets up, it's sort of like high 40s, low 50s, it gets really, really greasy and all the grip goes away. And that really solves your grip problems, your chatter problems. With cooler temps, if we've got, like, you know, 20 degrees, 22 degrees track temperatures, then or air temperatures, then you can have track temperatures of sort of, you know, low to mid 30s. And that's sort of perfect. That's going to be ideal grip. There's going to be lots and lots of grip. So I think, you know, chatter is going to be a real issue for the Ducatis there. I think they're really going to be looking forward to the test on Monday to be able to address those. The KTM is looking like a really good all-round bike. I mean, Brad Binder's foot should be a little bit healed. Jack Miller obviously has had a really good, really strong run there. Pedro Acosta is Pedro Acosta. And here comes my first prediction for the weekend. Pedro Acosta is going to nudge someone out of the way in turn 13 in the final corner, because it's his duty to do so. You know, all great champions manage to run someone else more or less off track at that final corner at some point. So I can see him. Also, he has the temperament to do that sort of thing, and if he's anywhere near the front, then someone is going to get a gas in the side. But it's quite open. And also, I really think this could be a good track for Aleix Espargaró. It's always been a strong track for him. It suits the Aprilia. You know, he can carry the corner speed that he wants through a lot of the corners onto the back straight, you know, through that final section. And I'm really fascinated to see what Maverick Vinales can actually do there, because he's in such a good place at the moment.
Yeah, I think Vinales is one of the biggest questions. I mean, you're right with Acosta as well, Dave. You know, he's a former winner at Jerez as well in the other classes. Maybe he needs, I mean, was Jerez the place where Valentino ran to use the Portaloo? It was also the place where Lorenzo decided to jump into a lake and almost drowned. You know, maybe Acosta needs to work out some particularly fruity celebration to, you know, really put himself into the Jerez folklore. But I mean, I agree with your observations about Ducati, but then, you know, Bagnaia has won the last two Grand Prix, Jack Miller the year before that. So that's why we were saying Ducati could go four in a row. I suspect that somebody like Miller could really be like the dark horse where, you know, based on what we've seen so far this season, you wouldn't really put him down as a podium threat. But, you know, he clearly has like Jerez nailed.
We keep on forgetting that there's this dude leading the championship who's actually fairly handy on a Ducati. I think you have to look at Jorge Martin. We know he's fast. I don't think he has sort of Jerez particularly like nailed on or anything, but he is, you know, he is fast and he's in a really, really, he's in really good shape. His worst, you know, worst result was in the main race on Sunday in Austin. Was it fourth? He's just in fantastic shape, and he goes into this weekend for me as the man to beat. It's just that I think there are a lot of riders who can actually beat him.
Yeah, and that's before we get to Marc Márquez, who obviously was showing race-winning form in Austin before he was befallen by front brake issues. You know, Márquez had a real mixed bag at the Jerez circuit in the last couple of years. But if you think back to 2022, on a pig of a Honda, he was up there fighting pretty much throughout the race with Aleix Espargaró. And I think Jack Miller, when he was on the factory Ducati for third place, on a Honda that had absolutely no right in being there. We obviously know what he was doing in 2020 before that accident, which has colored his career since then. But, you know, Mark has historically been really, really strong here. He hasn't quite had the same issues that's befallen the guys on the GP24 just yet. Obviously, the other guys in the GP23 aren't faring so well currently. But yeah, I think you have to throw Mark in the mix for sure.
I would say that someone who has done reasonably well on the 23 is Fabio Di Giannantonio. He's done. He's been sort of pretty good on the 23 so far. It's really been, especially Marco Bezzecchi who's struggled, and Alex Márquez as well. But I think Mark has the advantage of it being a completely new bike, so he's got no expectations, just to take in it. But I think Márquez is an excellent shout.
Dave, just to change subject momentarily and mention the other manufacturers, this is the first pre-season test, the first one-day post-race test of the season. Do you think that it's too early to be curious enough about the Japanese, or could they already have something in the bag to try and improve things?
Well, we know that Yamaha have got a new engine, which they wanted to try at Portimao and couldn't because it was raining. That will get rolled out sometime. They've got very little to lose by actually rolling it out on Friday and actually racing it and then actually refining it, using all of that data of the race weekend to put together a really solid test program for Monday. I think also we'll start to see some things coming from Honda. We know that Honda have got a massive test program. I think we've got three test riders doing wildcards as well. Lorenzo Savadori for Aprilia, Danny Pedrosa for KTM, and Stefan Bradl for Honda. And if Stefan Bradl is racing because there's a test on Monday, then you know that there's going to be lots and lots of stuff to do. And also, I mean, you know, first thing to do on Friday morning for me is pop down to the pits and have a look at Stefan's bike, because that's where all the good shit is.
Yeah, I mean, things are pretty dire in Qatar, obviously. They reached a new low, I think, in Portugal. And then, you know, things didn't really pick up in the United States for Honda. And for me, it was the time when the riders seemed the most dejected. I mean, the comments from sort of Joan Mir, Taka Nakagami in particular, and also Luca Marini just gave his debriefs with this weird sort of smile on his face, as if to say, I knew I would be in the shit, but not quite this much. Honda needs to be juicing, will be showing something at least. But anyway, listen, moving on to our second point. Obviously, with Dorna being acquired by Liberty Media, you know, a deal that still has to be ratified and approved in maybe 8-9 months' time, you know, there's probably one way in which MotoGP could change is having more of an international scope. And it could be the end of the days of having four Grand Prix on the Iberian Peninsula. I mean, well, we got five, I think, this year. So my question is to you guys for an opinion. Is Jerez actually the best track for the Spanish GP? And do you think we could see it move somewhere else? Because we'll have the Grand Prix this weekend and also in 2025, but that's when the contract finishes.
I mean, to me, it's the... I mean, like... I would like to see Jerez move to the end of the season. I'd like it to be the last race of the season. I think that would make much more sense, because the only reason we have it in Valencia is because then, you know, everyone gets to sleep in their own bed on Sunday night, everyone who lives in Barcelona, which would be a great deal more difficult if it was in Jerez. But I would like to see it move to the end of the season, because I think it would be better for the weather, it'd be better for testing. Valencia is a terrible track for testing. It doesn't really teach you very much, whereas Jerez is much more sort of it's a bit more rounded, and I think Jerez is such an icon of I mean, not just Spanish racing, but Grand Prix racing, that you, it would be very difficult to drop it from the calendar. I think there would be a real riot if they tried that. I think there's less I'm searching for the right word, really, but I mean, the people feel less sort of ownership of like Barcelona. They're less attached to Barcelona, to Valencia, to Aragon. It's easier to drop those in and out of the championship, and yet they're the ones with the nailed on contracts.
Yeah, I don't think it's maybe the best like layout of the Spanish tracks. I think you would probably have to give that to Montmeló or to, you know, the circuit of Barcelona, Catalunya, just because it's so undulating and spectacular. And if you go there as a fan, it's really, it kind of takes your breath away just how sort of pronounced the undulations are. But I think Jerez, what Div has just said, I think it, I agree with that. It's just become the Spanish Grand Prix, and it's been that way since 1987, or not always been the Spanish Grand Prix in that time, but it's been a mainstay on the calendar. It's always got a really vocal, vociferous, passionate fan base that packs out the grandstands and certain parts of the circuit. It's at that kind of time of year when it sort of signals the beginning of the European leg of the championship, which is always quite a bit of quite a landmark. And yeah, it, despite it being a bit hokey and a bit tight for MotoGP bikes, I think it still is a fantastic layout, which can really, it can really show up the strengths and weaknesses of a machine. And you know, it maybe always hasn't produced great racing in the past, but if you think back to last year, we had, as Dave said previously, two brilliant MotoGP races: the sprint and the feature race on the Sunday. And yeah, I just think as kind of an event, it's one of the highlights of the season. So yeah, I'm not sure I would say it's the best circuit on the calendar, but I think it's definitely the best Spanish event on the calendar. And, you know, its attendance, I think, speaks to that.
Okay, nicely put. Moving straight on to point three, guys. Danny Pedrosa, as you mentioned, Dave, making another wildcard appearance this weekend. Does he fight for a podium in Jerez? I mean, last year he took six in qualifying. I think he finished six in the sprint as well, and then was top seven in the Grand Prix race itself, and showed even more potential when he rode later in the year in Misano. So being back in Jerez, and you can see, I don't think either of us have seen Danny look so smiley across a whole the duration of a Grand Prix event in Jerez 12 months ago. But you know, could he actually, you know, produce a decent result this weekend? Thoughts?
I mean, I think yes. Can he do? Yes, he can produce a decent result. But you know, a decent result this year is much harder than a decent result last year. There are more people closer to the front. So you know, like second row, that will be difficult. You know, I think I think he'll get through to Q2, and I think he'll, you know, I think there's every chance of getting a couple of top 10 finishes. But doing as well as last year, I think it's going to be really difficult, just because the whole level has moved on so far, and there are more competitive bikes now.
Yeah, I agree with that, Dave. But I also think that he's going to be a guy that's in the mix. He's tested at Jerez fairly recently in the last couple of weeks. And I think Pit Barra was interviewed either during the Qatar race weekend or the Portuguese Grand Prix. And he said that he had the feeling that Danny was kind of building himself up to this weekend. So we know that Danny doesn't just do wild cards willy-nilly, doesn't just do them for the sake of it. He does it because he wants to feel competitive. He wants to feel that he can give a good account of himself. And the three times that he's wildcarded for KTM, he's done absolutely that. He's been sensational. I mean, Red Bull ring in 2021 and then two races last year. We're forgetting the last time he actually raced in MotoGP, he finished fourth, and at one point was looking as if he was capable of fighting with the top three at Misano last year. So, yeah, I agree that the top of MotoGP is a bit harder to ascend this year. There are more names up there, but I think Danny has shown in the last 12 months that he's more than capable of mixing it with the kind of current generation. And I think the fact that he has recent experience at this track will already be going into the weekend with a decent setup and knowledge of where to go from the first session. Yeah, I think Danny's going to be right in the mix. So yeah, I'm not saying he's going to win the race. I'm not even saying he's going to be in a podium, but I think he's going to be a contender.
Yeah, perhaps the only thing he's lost is a surprise factor. But if you think of Pedrosa, Miller's previous form, Binder's potential around Jerez as well, and then throw in Acosta, then it's looking pretty promising even before sort of, you know, the wheels roll into Jerez this weekend. So yeah, keep an eye on that one. 2024 is the 25th anniversary of Fly Racing. The brand have a mound of high quality but decently priced road gear and protective wares, but have become renowned for their helmet technology. We've talked about the advanced Formula S, but Fly have just released the Kinetic helmet, costing just under $130 or $140 depending on the model you choose, and it's a significant upgrade on one of their best-selling models. The DOT approved Kinetic has a dual density EPS, a polymer shell, and comes in four sizes for a precise fit. There are five colors and the blue edition is really cool. Have a look at flyracing.com. Okay guys, on to Wayne Rainey. Just some thoughts before we head straight to this interview. I recorded with him Saturday morning in Kota. We actually did the interview in a commentary booth, so it was a little bit noisy with the MotoGP session getting started behind us. But it was cool to sit down with just basically one of the huge icons of the sport. And personally, you know, Rainey was one of those guys that I almost wanted to will to lose, because he was that good and that dominant and just seemed to be part of that sort of evil empire of the Marlboro, you know, Roberts dominant force in Grand Prix racing at that time. To see a mistake or a miscalculation from him was extremely rare. Usually it was forced by like a Kevin Schwantz type of maneuver. Of course, we had Kevin Schwantz on the show last week, and just before we head into the audio, I just wondered if you could sort of tell me an anecdote or a memory or a story or just what you thought of him.
Yeah, I was probably in a similar position to you. I was a big Schwantz fan growing up, so wasn't always delighted when Rainey won, watching when I was younger. But I think as I grew older and learned a bit more about him, read Michael Scott's biography, which is a must read for any racing fan. I would absolutely urge anyone that hasn't already read it to do so. Yeah, you just, my respect for him grew, my admiration for him grew, and he's definitely one of my racing heroes, not just how he kind of navigated his career, but how he's navigated his life since his career ending accident in 93. And yeah, I think Rainey was obviously wonderfully gifted, massively, massively talented. But also is just, I think it was his mindset that set him apart, just the kind of the doggedness, the grit, how he would reach within himself to produce results which didn't seem really possible. There was a couple of years he was riding the Yamaha 500 and it seemed like it was the best bike in the grid, but I think towards the end of his career, you think to 92 93, I mean, the Yamaha was a real dog, and I think he won the championship in 92 just sheer willpower more than anything else.
Didn't he use the rock chassis? Might not have been the most, the rock chassis, did he use
it? Wasn't
that
93 point? I think it was,
right?
Yeah, I think the Yamaha was so hopeless that he basically chose another chassis during the year. Ultimately, he just couldn't really accept finishing second. And it was kind of the willpower that stood out more than anything. So, yeah, great champion and, someone I've got huge admiration for.
Yeah, I mean, same. I think one of the most impressive thing about Wayne Rainey is his career post-racing. You know, like, it obviously came to an early end because of his injury. But the way he built himself up, the fact that he was a team manager, he was a very successful team manager. And what he has done for Moto America, I think you just cannot overstate it. He has come in, helped to run the championship, given its stature, given its presence, using his name. But also, he is just very good at managing things. You know, he has very clear ideas about what the sport has to do to actually grow and to be successful in the US. And I think that to me is a much greater achievement. Well, not a much greater achievement. I think it's a really important achievement, which is often overlooked. In the same way that when you think about Valentino Rossi, obviously the first thing you think about is all of his wins, all of his celebrations and all the rest of it. But to me, you know, at least as great an achievement is the legacy that he leaves in Italian racing. You know, the VR46 Academy, all of these young kids coming up, creating a basis and stimulating the sport after he finished. like to me, that is always something that you read that gets, it's easy to overlook because people just remember the racing. But the you know, riders like Rainey and Rossi who go on afterwards to become really important in continuing to promote the sport and to make the sport bigger. That to me is really what, you know, that's an incredible achievement.
Thanks to Sean and the guys at Moto America for making the interview happen. Here's Wayne Rainey.
Wayne, thanks for talking to us. It's great to have you on the podcast. Firstly, apologies, because I imagine coming to a Grand Prix must almost be a little bit like it was when you were racing, because you seem to be being pulled from pillar to post in terms of commitments and interviews and whatever else.
Well, thanks for having me on your podcast. But it's not too bad, actually. When you're racing and you're the rider, you have to do all the same stuff, except you're only there to get the result. So there's that side of it that I'm not a part of. And but, you know, being able to come here to the track and at the MotoGP race, I still have a lot of friends, family, that I only see during the World Championship when they come to the U.S. So that's always a fun experience for me. But yeah, I've been busy because we have King of the Baggers here, but it's been a good experience. Everybody's very curious about the baggers.
Yeah, it is a novelty to see it. I always wish there were more of them out there. You know, it kind of looks a little bit like Moto E for a moment. But you know, we're talking here just as the free practice session is getting underway Saturday morning. And Wayne, just tell me how you feel. You're wearing the Moto America jacket. It's been something that you've been working on for quite a number of years now. How do you feel about the current status of the series? And particularly in the last few weeks, the last few months, in fact, for MotoGP, the American kind of orientation of it has changed quite a bit with the purchase of Dorna by Liberty Media. And then, of course, Trackhouse coming in. There's suddenly maybe some more doors opening.
Yes, for sure. As you said, the last couple of weeks has been big news here in the States, and it's probably the most news we've had about MotoGP in the last 20 years. So I think this is all very positive. You know, I remember when Greg Maffei did his interview on CNBC announcing Liberty acquiring MotoGP, and the commentator asked him, well, we know what F1 is, but what is MotoGP? She had no idea. And he goes, you're going to find out. So I thought that was exciting. I think it's something that we're lacking here. I just think we just need more exposure. It's something that's been very difficult in the past for Grand Prix racing. Even when I raced, that was the hardest bit. You know, maybe it's because, you know, the people that were doing marketing the sport back then, we were all sponsored by tobacco companies. So that was a bit difficult. But, you know, now it's much different. So I think there's an opportunity here. You know, with Trackhouse there now, that opens up a real possibility for American fans to follow a team, being an American-owned team with Justin Marks. So I think it's all good news. Now we got to keep working to get a good American on the bike, and so they can, I think the sport would explode then.
I mean, you've been working for a number of years to try and establish a structure where a young American kid could create something, some of a profile, some skill set, and then being able to come up to world championship level through Moto America. And I guess this also kind of completes a few more steps of the ladder, doesn't it? Because if you can go right to the top and there's an American interest, there's American team, there's American ownership, then it's going to be maybe a smoother route.
Well, we would hope so. It's there's no doubt when, you know, back when Americans were dominating the world championships because the American championship was so strong. All, you know, all the manufacturers raced here. And so there was a lot of racing seats that were very important. You know, we took over the championship 10 years ago and basically all the manufacturers were gone. We had Yamaha and Suzuki still there, but everybody else had disappeared. And so a lot of the interest in to race in America kind of went like, we got to go to Europe. We got to go to Spain. We got to go to Italy and even Britain. And so we've been, you know, trying to change that direction. And here we are 10 years later. And we've got a few riders in the world championship. Joe Roberts is in Moto2. I think he's at the top of the point standings. We keeping our fingers crossed here for Coda for his result. But certainly, You know, Moto America relies on sponsorship and ticket sales. So it's about the entertainment to get the fans to come back to the track. So, yeah, we're working really close with Dorna, and we're trying to create some opportunities for Americans to have that chance. But it's up until now, it's been difficult. You know, a young American would have to, you know, the family would have to, you know, sell their house and, you know, get a loan, go to Europe, live in a caravan, and have their 12 or 13 year old kid make sure that they can get the business done. That's a lot to ask for a young kid. And then you're in the Spanish Championship hoping you can get recognized. So that's a tough order. That's something that we need to change. We need to have some more access here from the stateside.
Oh, that's what Australians are doing, and South Africans, and, you know, it's there are not many, but people...
There's not many, yeah. But that's how you've had to do it, right? Yeah. But I think the reason why there are so many Spanish and so many Italians in the championship is because they don't have to do that. It's like in their backyard. And that's, you know, we need to make the American championship have the same type access, same opportunities, and we need to give them a chance. And once they're there, we hang in there with them. I think now what the way it's worked is that, you know, a young American will bring money to the team, and it's basically the team's, you know, going to use that to get their rider or their preferred rider up to speed. So, you know, we just need to change the mentality of that a little bit, and I think more opportunities could happen.
Wayne, when you were winning world championships, did you ever feel, or did you have that mental time and energy to work on the media side of it? I know the media landscape now is different to what it was kind of, you know, late 80s, early 90s. But, you know, did you think, you know, I'm the top of the pile here. I need to maybe need to be doing more pushing the sport in my country? Or was that not really something you could do?
Yeah, you know, we were, you know, just even to try to get on David Letterman or Jay Leno was like, we tried, just didn't happen. And I was 3-time world champion. Kenny Roberts had brought the U.S. Grand Prix back to the States, and we could not get a foothold in America. And everywhere else in the world, it was easy. But here, it was, you know, the stick and ball sports dominated all the media time, the air time. And, you know, people in the States like watching their sports from the couch. And so we had a lot of competition. But now, you know, back when I raced, though, there was no internet and no cell phones. Now,
social,
you know,
media,
yes, or... social media. So now, you know, the exposure is so much easier, so much broader. So now I think there's a lot of American celebrities that follow MotoGP. But if we had an American that was racing for the championship or racing for the podium as it used to be, I think the sport would explode.
So much of the championship is based in Europe, of course. You have, you know, numerous Spanish Grand Prix, a couple of rounds in Italy. So we can see quite well how local riders have to deal with that environment. But I just wondered what it was like for you going to Laguna Seca, you know, again, winning races, winning championships. As soon as you drove through the gate of that weekend, was it like an inferno?
It was crazy. I didn't realize I had so many friends that needed passes. You know, it was, I remember in 91, the last year I won the Grand Prix there, I bought a section of the grandstands, and I had like 100 tickets I had bought, and it was for my family and friends. I had them, they had food, they had a bar, and I just said, I'll see you on Sunday, just let me go out here and race, you know. So I had my media commitments, but, you know, yeah, I had a lot of friends, and racing in the States was the only time that we could come there, and the true American fans that followed us, you know, through the AMA championship could actually see us on the world stage. And we were very blessed back then because it was Americans dominating the world championship, especially in the 500 class, because of the technique and the way you had to ride those bikes then. You know, the Americans had we had an advantage. And I think also for the American fans is that we had, you know, the natural rivalries between the American riders. So it was the golden age, as they said, you know, how we missed those times.
Recently on the podcast, Wayne, we had a question that if we had to pick a rider from, say, 1985 to 1995 from the US who would adapt best to competing in MotoGP right now, who would it be? I pick you.
Good pick.
No, I just thought from what I've read about you and watched and everything, that's your mentality and the way you completely sort of dedicated yourself, you know, beyond 100% to here would fit into a 21 race, you know, well, it's more than that, like 42 race schedule and everything else that goes on now, having to do half, well, maybe a dozen TV interviews after sessions, the whole kind of spiel, not just the riding, but everything involved. I think Neil picked Freddie Spencer because he identified that fast starts would be a good attribute. Not that you were a bad starter.
I was going to say, maybe Neil's watched a few of my races.
And curiously, none of us picked Kevin. I don't know why that was. Maybe it was...
He likes doing the interviews.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, yes. We did all the work. We made him a star.
He would have been the media mogul. But, yeah. But, you know, if I can ask... It's a silly question, I know. But if I can ask you to transplant yourself from, say, 92 to now, how do you think you would fare as an athlete?
I don't see things changing much. I think I'd be right fighting for the podiums every race. I love the technology. You know, we were the, you know, my team and myself in, you know, I like trying new things. You know, we had carbon brakes. We put the computer on the bike. We trusted the information. We developed the information. And this was all groundbreaking stuff. And of course, none of it's going to work unless a rider's involved. The rider wants to do it. The rider understands it. And that's something that we did. You know, I think we were way ahead of the other teams and the other manufacturers because, you know, Kenny gave us that opportunity. So current bikes with the wings and all the other rider aids that they have, I would have helped develop that stuff and loved it. But I guess that answers your question.
Yeah. But when you say Kenny gave you the opportunity, why do you think that was? I mean, is that because you had like Ago and, I don't know, Jerry Burgess? You had other team bosses in the paddock who are maybe not as flexible to the needs of the rider?
Well, I think, you know, Kenny and I coming from the U.S., you know, racing flat track, you know, Kenny developed his own chassis when he raced. He rode Yamahas against the Harley-Davidsons, and the Harley-Davidsons was a much more dominant bike. So you had to be very, think outside the normal way of riding a bike, and you had to set your bikes up quite a bit different. And I was the same way. You know, my dad, he built a lot of my racing bikes as I was growing up as a kid. You know, he put suspension on my little Z50 Honda Cub. We had nitromethane on it. You know, there was we did a lot of things, and so as a young kid, I was able to adapt, and I liked trying new things to see if it would work better on the track. You know, in my GP career, you know, I swapped tire brands basically almost every year. Michelin to Dunlop and back and forth. No other rider did that. And it was a shitload of effort by the team and the rider and the manufacturer to develop the bikes for these tires every year. But I loved it. You know, I loved being able to beat Michelin when I was the only Dunlop rider. When I was a Michelin rider, I was like everybody else. And so I remember Michelin used to say, or I would tell Michelin, you know, if I could have this tire, a little different profile, they go, Wayne, you got the same tires as Mick and Kevin, and you're just going to have to make your bike work better. And with Dunlop, they would actually build me a tire. So,
okay.
I missed that part.
What about the whole time scale factor of it though, Wayne? Because, you know, like I said, 21 rounds. I mean, just to give the listeners an idea, how much testing were you doing?
We did a lot more testing than what these guys do. You know, we were flying to Goiânia, Brazil, in the, you know, on Thanksgiving morning, national holiday in the States. And I would take turkey sandwiches onto the airplane on my way to Goiânia, Brazil. And this racetrack was in the middle of nowhere. And it you couldn't actually see the track because of all the bushes and weeds and grass growing up around it. But when you were on the circuit, it was smooth, it was hot, and it was very abrasive. And I would go there for 4 or 5 days and test 500 different tires. And these riders don't get that opportunity to go do that. Maybe Goiânia, Brazil is not so exotic, but the tire testing that I was able to do, I think that was the reason why I was so quick on at the beginning of the race, because I was very comfortable on new tires.
Did they fix that track towards the end of the 80s? Because it had that distinctive red dirt. I don't know if it got very dirty. Yes. Or they resurfaced it at
no,
some point.
No, I'm sure the red dirt's still there. I think the last time we raced there was 1989.
Yeah.
I recall.
That's when Eddie won the championship, right?
Yeah. Or... Yeah. Yeah, Eddie, he nipped the championship from me that year.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm still not over that.
testing and everything else. I know one thing Dorna maybe want to do now with MotoGP is extend the footprint of it, you know, so when there's an off season, people are still seeing content, they're talking about it, you know, a little bit like US sports, like the NFL has a very short season, but then people tend to talk about football in the US a lot more, you know, during the off season stuff. And maybe there's going to be more demands. Again, did you feel like you had a break when you were racing?
Yes, I did. You know, at least I had a good month off. You know, the sport has changed. Motorsports has changed. I think, you know, the way the public can get their content now is just, it's at their fingertips. So if we want to keep expanding the sport, we have to give them what they want. And I think, you know, we need to tell more personal stories about the riders themselves. We need to go into the workshops and show what we're doing with these bikes. What are they developing? Why are they developing in the way that they are? We don't have to give away the secrets, but we have to explain so the public understands how sophisticated these bikes are. You know, personally, I'd like to see them take some of this technology, rider aids, I guess, off a little bit, or at least give some of the control of the bike
to the rider, you mean?
Back to the rider. Yes. It's like we were talking here. I'd like to see the bike a little more harder to get off the corner, especially a low gear corner. You'd like to see the rider have the influence. You'd like to see the bike look a little bit more aggressive. But now watching them out of this low gear corner, it's amazing. Everybody looks exactly the same. The exact same speed, the exact same line. Everybody looks the same. And it's really, it's kind of sad.
It's uniform,
you know? Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, I'd like to see them liven up the spec a little bit.
Well, you and I were talking a bit about this before we started recording. How is MotoGP spectacular now? Because it's in a different way, right? It's not the sliding. It's not necessarily the smoke and tires so much. But then when you see Wayne, like in a talent like Pedro Acosta come through, I mean, 2 world championships in 3 years, 19 years old, he's still doing stuff on the track that's maybe a little bit different. He's able to show that the rider can make a bit of difference.
Yes. I think one thing that people were talking about, it was a lack of passing. And then you have this Pedro comes around and he doesn't know that he's not allowed to pass. So he goes out there and goes, I think I can just outbreak this guy, or I can change my line through the corner and set him up and get him in the next turn. And it's been a real, for me, it's been a real fresh for the sport to see somebody new that's a rookie that is like not too intimidated and he's getting results right away. You know, if he can stay healthy, he's going to be a problem for all these guys, for sure.
Wayne, what was it like for you, you know, post-racing and then moving into different phases of your life and your career, just to, I mean, we're talking about the riders here with their mentalities. I'm just interested in the psychology of somebody who's constantly looking for performance gains every single day to then come away from that, but then also stay in an environment where you're surrounded by people who are still trying to do the same thing. It must be like, a little memory reminder almost every week.
Yeah, well, you know, my situation was a little bit different than, you know, with my racing accident. You know, this was never the plan, obviously. So, but, you know, racing has been my life. It's, you know, it's given me everything that I have. I love the sport. I love everything about it. Love the people, the fans. And so, you know, there was a lot of opportunities after my accident. So I did that. I think I ran my team for 6 years. But that was an adjustment for me doing all that. And so then when I got away from, when I stopped the team and I came home and I got away from the sport for about 5 or 6 years, and I was really able to kind of be like a normal man trying to live every day without having this racing stuff in my life. And there was an adjustment there, and it was, you know, I kind of was like a normal guy. And then I found that over time, I started thinking about racing again, and I had some opportunities, and, you know, we brought the U.S. Grand Prix back to Laguna Seca. So that was a whole different part of racing that I had never done. I'd never worried about promoting the sport in the States or getting a race, but, you know, with you know, my name helped open some of those doors, and we were able to bring the GP back to Laguna Seca. And so that was a real thrill for me there. And then my son went off to university, and my wife says, you got to find something to do. And, you know, I met a good friend of mine now. His name is Richard Varner, which is, he's a partner with me that when we started Moto America. And, you know, I helped him build the bike, and through that bike build, it whet my appetite to go start looking in America to see what was missing. And I asked him, I said, what do you think about building, try to do something in America to try to revive the championship? So here we are 10 years later, and we are racing American Iron at MotoGP with King of the Baggers. Whoever would have thought?
Oh, yeah, the reason I ask is I read your book, and I remember thinking, achieving as a kid who's also loving motorcycles, who had a mother who was too safety conscious to let her son actually have a go on one, I thought...
So you weren't allowed to ride?
I wasn't allowed. Oh. I was okay. I was happy watching it and finding another avenue to sort of be around the sport. But I remember thinking, achieving all of this stuff and being number one, and, you know, it didn't seem great fun. It didn't seem like the dreamy sort of life. I mean, it seemed like you were obsessed by continually having to be up there. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound like, you know, the boyhood dream. I mean, when you think back on it now, did you think, oh man, should I have lightened up a bit more? Should I really have, you know, appreciated what I had? I don't know.
All the above. That's a very good question. And I've had 30 years to think about it. And I understand why I was successful, why I was world champion. And I was obsessed in every part of what it took to be the best that I could be on the track. You know, my competition, they were so awesome. You know, I had to do everything I could in my possession to try to find the performance out of myself. But saying that, I'd lost the sense of fun from racing when I look back all those years. In some strange way, and you know, you mentioned the book, but I haven't thought about this in a long time, but I remember when I was laying on the track in Misano, one of the thoughts I had that came across my mind was, oh, it's finally over. And I had no idea what was wrong with me, but I had that thought, and it was just like
a relief.
Yeah, it was like really strange. But when I look back 30 years and I think about that, I should have had more fun with it. I think, why didn't I have more fun? Why couldn't I just say, okay, second's okay, or third? But it wasn't. You know, I wanted to win. And, you know, if I could go back there now, I would change the perspective a little bit. I would have probably changed things up. But who in their life can look back over 30 years and say, you know what, there's a few things I could change? I'm one of those guys.
Glorious hindsight. I mean, the reason I asked that is because you said that doing the promotion and getting back in touch with racing was a thrill. So, you know, for you still having that contact, that empathy with what's going on out there at elite level is something that's ingrained in you, right?
Yeah, you know, of course, I root for the American guys. I'd like to see the American championship healthy. But I'm also a realist that, you know, the culture has changed in the States. Racing has changed. I've seen what has happened in Spain and in Italy and in Europe. It's like, wow. I mean, they have taken what we had and accelerated it. So, you know, that model there is something that we have to try to adapt here a little bit and make sure the opportunities are there for the riders that want to go chase that and have the talent and have the desire. We just have to make sure we don't miss those chances and trying to create opportunities. And, you know, as far as Moto America and the buzz it gives me, I've got, you know, with Chuck Axlin and Richard and the team that we have at, they do the heavy lifting, you know, so I get to come enjoy the races a little bit more. But it's been 10 years of a lot of work, there's no doubt.
Well, Wayne, as I said earlier, they have a MotoGP fantasy thing going on in the sport now, and you would definitely be my pick for the team. So thanks ever so much for your time. I know, you, like as we said earlier, you're extremely busy at these things, and for talking to us, and best of luck for everything with Moto America.
Thank you very much. I've had a good time on your podcast.
All right, guys, on to the last phase of the show, the Alpine Stars Paddock Pass Podcast Fantasy League. Am I winning at the moment from us four?
I think so. You're about eight places ahead of me or something.
Right. I think Steve's ahead, if you know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you tampered with his team. I think,
but
he
despite
said,
that, I think he's still doing okay.
I think he was 880th out of 887 or something like that. I mean, it was ridiculous. But yeah, we'll have a look. Guys, if you want to join us, I think you can still join. Maybe if you're part of the MotoGP fantasy competition, if you just sign up to the Alpine Stars Paddock Pass podcast, then you can join us with your current points total. I've been shit, but I still think I'm leading from the four of us. So I'll hang on to that one. Alpine Stars will be giving away a prize package for the winner at the end of the season. And on that note, I want to ask David and Neil for your predictions for the Grand Prix this weekend.
I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a great race. It's going to be really difficult. And like, I don't think it's going to be a Ducati. I think there is a much better chance. I think there's going to be at least one KTM on there. I think we're going to see Pedro Acosta on the podium. I think we're going to see Marc Marquez on the podium. And then Jorge Martin, Brad Binder, it could be anyone.
A prediction, Dave.
All right. Okay. Well, in that case, Pedro Acosta is going to beat Marc Marquez after barging him out of the way at turn 13, and then Marc will wag his finger in the traditional time honored manner in the Jerez Park Ferbe.
Beat that one, Neil.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I don't know if I can go that detailed, but I do think Pedro has a really good chance of winning this weekend just because he's been phenomenal in the last couple, well, since he joined MotoGP. He's been punching way above his weight and doing things that we didn't think were quite possible of a rider stepping into MotoGP as a 19-year-old rookie in this day and age. So why stop there? I mean, he went to Cota, a place that he doesn't really know that well, and was fast from the first session. So Jerez is a place he knows super well, and why can't he just get up there? It's also a great track for KTM. He's been consistently outperforming Binder and Miller all year. So why can't he go up there and shoot for the stars? So yeah, I'm going to say Costa to win this weekend.
Poor Pedro, he was hoping for a good Grand Prix. Now look what's going to happen to him. I'm going to say that Brad Binder will come blasting back, and I think the Maverick Viñales train is going to keep on chugging down the railway line. So, you know, watch out for the Aprilia. Guys, just before we move on to the end of the show, I want to ask you for a favorite Jerez memory, because when you really raid the memory banks, take your time, Dave, I'll come to you last, then, you know, there's some priceless stuff. I mean, everything from Sam Lowe's fantastic rear-wheel drifting first win in Moto2, actually, it was a first win, but it was a fantastic win anyway. If you think of 2016 and Brad Binder, we just mentioned him winning from the back of the grid in Moto3, you know, Rossi's victory as well. I think for me, though, the thing that stands out the most, maybe recency bias, is Marc Marquez. It was coming through 11 and 12, 2019, where there were some stones on the track. The rear end of the Honda just like stepped out, and it was scary and brilliant and just awe-inspiring at the same time, the way he managed to control that. And I have to see if it's on YouTube somewhere, but I remember thinking, wow, you know, if this guy hadn't shown us that he was special enough as it is, but to get away with that was pretty impressive. So Neil, what stands out for you from Jerez?
Well, there's so many memories I had. I mean, if we're talking about races, I would probably go for either Rossi on Gibernau 2004, which was, in fact, sorry, 2005, the first race 2005 it was. I mean, seminal MotoGP moment, has been replayed over and over and over again. It wasn't just the move, it was the reaction in Parc Fermé. It was the kind of the baiting of the Spanish crowd as he was on the podium afterwards. I mean, it was just brilliant kind of theater. And also the 500 race in 1996 with Doohan on Crivier at the final turn, with the fans coming onto the track a lap early because the trackside commentator had made the mistake of calling the race one lap early. So everyone thought the race was already finished. There was still one lap to go, and Doohan, Crivier, I think it was Luca Cadalora, was in third as well, herring around the kind of stadium section off the track with all the fans climbing over the barriers to jump on, thinking they were doing their victory parade, but they were still going flat out at racing speeds. And then Doohan cleanly passed Alex Crivier into the final corner. Crivier high-sided, trying to cut back underneath Doohan, and made a real mess of it. And then I think his side of the Repsol Honda garage, they asked the organizers to cancel the last lap because, you know, there were fans at the side of the track, and that was that should have brought the red flags out, made the kind of the final lap invalid, which really did not go down well with Mick Doohan's side of the box. So talking points are plenty, and a personal memory, I think Jerez was not the first time I went to a MotoGP race, but the first time I went to Jerez as a fan, 2012, I'm going to say, Casey Stoner just dominating and leading from the front. Much to the chagrin of the stadium section at Jerez, which was hoping for a Jorge Lorenzo victory. But that was, you know, first time spectating at Jerez was pretty special. And if anyone hasn't done it, I would highly recommend doing so.
Yeah, I mean, that 96 race was a classic and worth going back to. And there are, it's just sad, it's really hard to pick one thing because there are so many things. I think Marc Marquez's 2020 race, up until the moment he sort of flicked himself off of that bike, which was it him or was it the bike? You can argue up. But coming through the field, that was one of the best pieces of riding I've seen in a very, very long time.
Ever.
That was just genuinely spectacular. He was, you know, a second a lap faster than everyone else on a dry track, and that's just not supposed to be possible. But I think another memory for me was the first race of 2006. Tony Elias taking out Valentino Rossi at the first corner, leaving him sort of dumped there. And that was like the first sign that, oh, right, okay, everything is not completely magic. You know, up until that point, everything Valentino Rossi touched turned to gold. And it was like the first little sort of warning bell that, okay, this isn't going to be quite as easy as it turned out to be. And, you know, it was the start of a fascinating, one of the best seasons ever. Fascinating, weird, strange, lots of just weird things happening. And then Tony Elias, of course, managing to take five points off of Valentino Rossi at Estoril in that fantastic race, which really made a huge difference to the championship. So, yeah, I mean, it was that I remember distinctly watching that, thinking, oh, that's not supposed to happen. That's not a good start to the season. I wonder what's going to happen here.
Yeah, and just to chide in, another great memory I was actually watching as a spectator again, 2013, Marquez on Lorenzo, Jorge Lorenzo turn. The turn had just been christened the Jorge Lorenzo corner, and then as a rookie, Mark was fighting with Lorenzo for second place in that year's Spanish GP, and just really just led one on him going into that final turn, pushing him off track. And again, there was a lot of finger wagging afterwards. It was a beautiful sporting drama.
Yeah, so, and that's it, as I say, this is definitely going to happen again this weekend.
Is Jerez also the place where Valentino's ambition outweighed his talent?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. When he ended up taking up again, that again is a story which has all sorts of little consequences which you don't sort of realize, that, you know, Valentino Rossi losing the front, wiping out Casey Stoner, and Casey couldn't get the bike started again because they just switched to the seamless gearbox, and they couldn't actually bump start the bike with the seamless gearbox, so they ended up having to change the gear locks to have a lockout, so they can actually lock the thing in first gear to be able to bump start the bike again. So there's is one of those little things. It has all these tiny little repercussions that you don't really think about, it just sort of went on to have an effect.
Yeah, and all the marshals were busy helping Valentino get started.
They were all pushing Valentino back up. Yeah, exactly.
He got the famous slow clap as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a busy weekend coming up. We hope we've whet the appetite. We'll have the first slice of the Paddock Note Show from the Media Centre on Thursday evening, and then we'll have exclusive daily shows for our Paddock Insiders on Patreon on Friday and Saturday. We'll also chat and engage with our insiders through Discord, so join up now for $10 a month for extra content. The World SBK Show will be online for all and sundry on Friday, and then we'll have our race review podcast online Sunday night. Thanks for listening.